This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am having an Ask Us Anything session with OBGYN Dr. Erica Montes. We will cover the following topics: pregnancy monitoring after COVID infection, the second COVID booster in pregnancy, recommendations for interpregnancy interval, recommendations for exercise and activities after a diagnosis of short cervix, progesterone for short cervix, tubal ligation during a cesarean delivery, intrauterine growth restriction, different ways to push during labor and delivery, the safety of Tylenol in pregnancy, fetal kick counts, antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, uterine atony, fetal hiccups, and elective hysterectomy. Have a listen. Thank you, Dr. Erica Montes at The Modern Root Hair here on Instagram for joining me today for an Ask Us Anything. So I put out a feeler for some questions, and I picked out some that are some topics we haven't really covered before, and I thought were really good questions, and we're going to tackle them. Are you up for it?
I'm up for it. Let's do it, Dr. Clark.
All righty. So I'm going to start off with some COVID questions. Okay. The first, one of the questions I got was, what sort of follow-up monitoring might you do for a third trimester patient who had COVID? So this is from SMFM's latest clinical guidance, because SMFM continually updates it, and I believe their last update was sometime in late March, perhaps. Don't remember exactly.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So basically, what the thought is, and this is not definitive, but what the thoughts are that infection in the second trimester tends to be more associated with an increased risk of adverse obstetric outcomes, whereas infection in the third trimester could be more related to adverse neonatal outcomes. So that usually means you're infected in the third trimester and that would require a delivery, which may be preterm, and that could be cause more of the adverse neonatal outcomes. Whereas infection in the second trimester, you're more likely to stay pregnant. And that's where you hear about risk of the preeclampsia-like syndrome and stillbirth,
right, just
to name a couple. There's no formal recommendations, but what the SMFM is saying is this. If you have had first trimester or periconception, meaning right around the time you conceived, COVID infection of any severity, a detailed anatomy ultrasound at the 18 to 22 week mark should be considered. That is different than a basic anatomy scan. A basic anatomy scan is typically done in low risk patients, whereas a detailed anatomy scan might be done because someone's advanced maternal age, they have medication exposure, anything that would require a more detailed assessment of the fetal anatomy. So they're suggesting that that should be considered if someone had COVID infection periconceptionally or in the first trimester. Growth assessments, meaning starting serial growth scans, they can also be considered depending on the timing, meaning when the COVID infection occurred and the severity of the disease. And also if there are other adverse outcomes, maternal risk factors, for example,
right,
a patient that's diabetic and chronic hypertensive and they had COVID infection. Now, if you're diabetic or hypertensive or both, you're going to be getting serial ultrasounds anyway for growth. But obviously adding on COVID to that infection sometime during the pregnancy is going to further endorse that. But there's no recommendation on when to start, how often to do them. Various practices are doing various things. When you talk about the risk of stillbirth, and we're getting more and more information about there being a possible and likely association with an increased risk of stillbirth, there's no recommendations on when to start fetal surveillance. And what fetal surveillance typically means is like getting non-stress tests or BPPs or things like that to assess fetal well-being. So what SMFM is recommending is that those tests be done for other or routine obstetric indications, like you've had diabetes, hypertension, although I know some practices are implementing fetal testing or fetal surveillance for COVID, and that's within their right to do so. As far as delivery, having COVID is no, like, for example, you had it at 28 weeks. That doesn't mean you have to deliver at 37 weeks. That doesn't mean you have to deliver at 39 weeks. The timing of delivery might be changed or be more pressed if you get COVID infection later in pregnancy, then that might require that you be delivered early. But if you recover earlier in pregnancy, then you should be delivered for what we call routine obstetric indications, not just because you had a COVID infection that you've already recovered from. Now, the last thing I want to address is, I get this question a lot. I'm getting put on low-dose aspirin and heparin injections. There is no recommendation for that. But I think the reason why docs are doing it is because this association with code infection and the preeclampsia-like syndrome. Sorry, let me take a drink.
Okay.
And I get that because you hear the word preeclampsia. And what do we do for people at increased risk for preeclampsia? We recommend low dose aspirin. The caveat is this. The mechanism for the effect of preeclampsia on the placenta is not the same as the mechanism of the effect of COVID on the placenta. They might cause the same end result, but the mechanism is different. So we have no evidence that low-dose aspirin, and definitely not heparin injections or Lovenox injections, are going to improve or decrease the risk of the preeclampsia-like syndrome with COVID that may develop. So that's why that's not recommended. Like I said, although it's a preeclampsia-like syndrome, it's called a preeclampsia-like syndrome because the mechanism is different and its effects on the placenta are different. So in my practice, we do not do... Yeah. Go ahead.
And I don't think we're recommending it, you know, postpartum either, even if they're currently infected at the time of delivery.
So the only time to get blood thinners or Lovenox or heparin is if a pregnant patient is acutely affected and hospitalized.
Yes.
Once they're well enough to go home, there's no recommendation to continue any kind of anticoagulation. Okay. And then as far as the booster, we don't have the ACIP met on April 6th. I thought they were going to put out a recommendation. They did not. Right now, it's only recommended the second booster for those over 50, especially those with underlying medical conditions. Hopefully, it will come out soon. So I go by what the ACIP recommends. So when the ACIP recommends that second booster in pregnant individuals, I will endorse that. So I get that question a lot as well. Again, it's up to you and your provider what you want to do, but me personally, I go by what the ACIP says. What about you?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I have a lot of patients that are still asking me, when can I get my second booster? Is it out yet? Am I available? Mm-hmm. You know, should I get it? And I just say, we haven't heard yet, but we're waiting, basically.
Yeah. With the COVID vaccine, I think we should go by what ACIP says, because they're working night and day to put these recommendations out. And, my practice is goes by what the CDC and ACIP recommend. Okay, Dr. Montes, what is the definition, I get this question a lot, between inter-pregnancy interval versus inter-delivery interval? Is there a difference? And if there is, what's the difference?
Yeah, sure. So an inter-pregnancy interval is basically from the time between your one pregnancy to the next pregnancy, whether it be a live birth or a pregnancy loss. And then inter-delivery interval is when you go from the time between one delivery versus another delivery, not including a pregnancy loss. So, you know, I think this is a great question because we know that as physicians and providers who take care of pregnant people, it's important that we ask questions, we bring that question up. When are you, do you want to become pregnant in this next year? Mm-hmm. What are your plans for pregnancy? Because that can affect pregnancy outcomes. And also it can help us optimize comorbidities that these pregnant women or pregnant patients have. So what the recommendations show strong evidence for is that if you avoid an pregnancy interval, what they recommend, there is that caveat where they say there could be a benefit if you wait until you get pregnant 18 months from your last pregnancy, but that's kind of a weak recommendation. We can't say for sure if that can decrease adverse outcomes. So I think overall it's important for us to take the time during especially the annual exam visit or even especially in the postpartum visit and kind of go through those questions, make sure everyone has access to affordable and great birth control or contraception, if that's what they want to do. And just kind of know that it's one of those things that it actually can make a big difference. And I think that we as doctors need to make sure that we ask our patients those questions.
Mm-hmm. And what about your patient that is advanced maternal age, over age 35, and I get this question a lot. You know, I know it's ideal to wait 18 months if I can, but I'm 38, I'm 39, I'm 40. What should I do? And I want that second baby. What should I do?
Yeah, I mean, I want them to at least wait those 6 months because I think that that definitely will decrease those adverse outcomes. It's hard to have someone wait the 18 months that, you know, that anyway has re weak recommendations. But one thing I would say too is, especially if you've had a C-section, you want to wait, you know, at least 12 to 18 months if possible, especially if you want to try for that trial of labor after cesarean because you're at risk for a uterine rupture. And I wouldn't really want my patients to try, especially if it hasn't been at least 12 to 15 months. So to try for a TOLAC or a vaginal birth after delivery.
Yeah, and I think it's good to be proactive, you know, and it's also going to
Right.
depend on if there were any extenuating circumstances with your delivery. Did you have a classical cesarean? Did you have
Exactly.
really bad preeclampsia? Did you have anything else that might warrant that you wait a little bit longer, even if you are in an age group of over 35? We still have to think about those
Right.
things. And if there's any question, you could always do a preconception consult with either your OBGYN or someone like myself, like OBGYN like
Right.
Dr. Motis, or an MFM like myself, and we can give you some recommendations on what we think based on what happened with your last delivery, whether or not we should take it a little bit beyond 6 months before you try for that, you know, try to conceive again. But we also understand that not
I
everything is
know.
planned, and what I don't want people to do is freak out if it was 5.5 months. I mean, things
Right.
happen. And
Exactly.
we will just have to keep that in mind and do any necessary workup or surveillance that we need to do in order to get the best outcome. But at the end of the day, it's really a personal decision. What we're saying is make an informed personal decision, right?
Exactly. That's a great way to say it. And like we said, I mean, preconceptual counseling is, you know, is ideal, but we know that that's not going to happen for everyone. And if you know that you have comorbidities and you had a high risk pregnancy or risk during your pregnancy, be proactive, take the initiative to come talk to us about it so we can help you have a better outcome with your next pregnancy.
And one other thing, if you deliver and you know that you're probably not going to go back to that practice for whatever reason, you're moving or whatever, please make sure you get those delivery records and have access to those delivery records. There's a
Very
lot of
important.
times I will even make sure my patients have them before they leave because I have a very transient population that don't always come back for the subsequent deliveries. So it's always better that they have that medical information, especially if there was any kind of complication.
Great
Okay,
point.
next
Thank you.
question. Was what are the current recommendations on exercise and activities with a short cervix diagnosed before 24 weeks? Just a second.
Yeah, that's a great one. We get that
Yeah.
question a lot.
So basically, we're talking about just a short cervix. We're not talking about funneling membranes or prolapsing membranes, just a short cervix, which is considered less than 2.5 centimeters. In an otherwise, say you just happen to find that on the antenatal scan, anatomy scan that's done at 18 to
Right.
22 weeks, you know, you drop below 2.5 centimeters, then you are a candidate for vaginal progesterone. And there's no recommendation to restrict physical activity, and that includes bed rest, limiting work, avoidance of vaginal intercourse, you know, none of that has been shown to reduce the likelihood of preterm birth. And those at risk for preterm delivery. And that includes someone who has a short cervix less than 2.5 centimeters. Now, with that being said, you have to have that conversation with the individual provider that knows you the best. Would I go out and run marathons? No. But the thing is, bed rest is not the best option. And that can cause more harm than good. So before you accept any recommendation for strict bed rest, you need to make sure that is absolutely in your best interest. Because there could definitely be an increased risk with that. Can you modify activities? Sure. Can you not have intercourse because it makes you too nervous? I was that way. I was too nervous to have intercourse, and I knew that if anything happened after I had sex, I was going to freak out. So I didn't do it because it was going to help me. I just couldn't mentally handle it, and that's fine. But the data do show that none of these measures reduce the risk. So going on complete bed rest is not ideal for anyone. The other thing that they wanted to talk, another question they had is about progesterone for short cervix. Now, there's two types of patient populations. I'm going to go through this very quickly. I have another live discussion on all things progesterone that covers this in more detail. But just real quickly, if you are a singleton pregnancy and you have no history of preterm birth and you go to the 18 to 22 week scan, most routinely now, most people are doing a transabdominal cervical length assessment, and if it appears short, they will do a transvaginal exam.
Right.
If it's less than 2.5 centimeters, what's indicated is to do a speculum exam just to make sure the membranes are not exposed and the cervix does not look dilated. If it's not, then you're a candidate for vaginal progesterone. That's it. Vaginal progesterone. Right. Now, if you have a singleton pregnancy and a history of preterm birth, what's typically going to be recommended are serial cervical lengths starting at, where did I have it? 16 weeks.
Right.
And they're going to be repeated every 1 to 4 weeks, depending on the length of your cervix. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be continued until 23 weeks and 6 days. If your cervical length drops below 2.5, you are a candidate, centimeters, you are a candidate for either a cerclage or vaginal progesterone. Okay. Back up. The 17 OHP injections.
Yes.
Everybody ask about that. They are still being done. We still use them, but I have a higher risk patient population. So I know there's conflicting data, but the SMFM and ACOG still recommend using it in the patient populations that were initially studied, which were the higher risk patient populations. Mm-hmm. So if you have a history of preterm birth and you fall into that category, it may be recommended to you that you take the injections. But the other option is to do vaginal progesterone starting earlier on, ideally between 16 to 20 weeks is the best time mm-hmm. to start it, but you can start it as late as 28 weeks. But just know that if you have a history of preterm birth, get into care early so the best yes. decision can be made for you. I'm not going to go into a history of cervical insufficiency or cervical incompetence. That's another topic. We're just talking about short cervix. So there are different ways that we can handle this. Just know that 17 P injections are still recommended for high-risk populations. You can also do vaginal progesterone if you have a history of preterm birth. But serial cervical lengths are still recommended. So if you started on that 17P or vaginal progesterone and you're doing a serial cervical lengths and your cervical length drops below 2.5 and you get that cerclage, you keep continuing whichever form of progesterone you were on. Okay. Great. If you decided not to do any progesterone and you just opted for the serial cervical lengths and it drops below 2.5, then you typically just do the cerclage. So that's kind of how the rules of the short cervix game are. Do you do anything differently with your patients?
No, that's exactly what I do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've been using the vaginal progesterone a little bit more lately, just because sometimes it can be a little harder to get the Makena to be approved or what have you, but I've been having really good results with it. So I've been happy with it.
And we still use it in ours because a lot of our patients fall into that high-risk patient population mm-hmm. that was originally studied for 17P. But, you know, if patients don't want the injections, mm-hmm. that's fine. We can do vaginal progesterone. Okay.
Perfect.
Next question. This is a good one. Is it safe to get a mm-hmm. tubal ligation right after birth if delivery is a cesarean? How is it done? What's the failure rate? And then I'll ask you the next question. So basically, is it safe to get a tubal ligation during the course of a C-section? How is it done?
Yeah, sure. So that's a great question. I think it is very safe. It's convenient. It's very effective. If we're already there at, you know, in the region or the vicinity of the tubes and we're doing the C-section, it's pretty quick to do and it's very easy. You can do either a partial salpingectomy where we take a portion of the tube out or the complete salpingectomy where we take both the entire tubes out. I think that it's important for patients to know that if you are thinking about a tubal, especially if you're going to have a C-section, bring that up early. So that way, if there's mm-hmm. any consents that need to be signed, as far as like your insurance goes, we can get that done and we can get it taken care of. And I feel like I'm pretty good about asking my patients because mm-hmm. I want them to know that that's an option for them. As far as the failure rate goes, the CREST study shows with a partial salpingectomy, it's about 6 out of 1,000 people would become pregnant after 5 years. So, you know, that's actually a pretty good rate. Overall, though, it's important to realize that the LARCs or the long-acting reversible contraceptive methods actually have a slightly better rate as far as a little bit less failure compared to a tubal. But if that's something that you want to do, I think it's a great option. It's safe and easy and it's convenient for you.
Mm-hmm. And then what about, is there such thing as a postpartum tubal ligation syndrome of any type?
You know, I don't
like to hate that question. I know it's a tough question.
I mean, you know, I personally, I guess it's hard. Like, I don't know how to answer that because I can't say that, like, I've had a patient for sure that has told me, like, I have those symptoms of, like, hormone changes. Yes, I mean, they've studied the effects of a tubal after many years on this CREST study and how menstrual changes could potentially happen and that there's possibly an increased risk of a hysterectomy after many years if you had a tubal, but we can't say that that's due to the tubal. So, you know, I would say it depends on who you ask, but I don't know. What do you think, Shannon? I mean, have you seen that, or what do you think about that?
I've heard of it. I haven't specifically seen it. And it's these types of studies are so hard to do because there's so many what we call confounding factors and so many variables involved. And so getting clean data and saying the risk of postpartum tubal ligation syndrome after a tubal ligation is this. And I don't know that we'll ever get that data. But it's still a surgery. Right. We are still cutting out a portion of your tube. Scar tissue can develop. That could be a component of this. So it's a surgery just like anything else. So talking to your provider about something like a LARC or other forms of contraception is ideal. I think most of my patients want the convenience of it because they're already getting a cesarean.
Right.
And we also do postpartum tubal ligation. So after our patients do their vaginal, we'll do their, we do that. And that's just with an incision under the belly button and we pull up the tubes and tie them that way or ligate them that way. But it's basically on patient preference. I don't think there's enough definitive data to say that, yes, it absolutely does exist. And this is this postpartum tubal ligation absolutely does exist. And this is what it consists of. We can't say that. We also don't want to discount anybody that's potentially having complications. I think more research needs to be done. And the best way to study that needs to be figured out. We just haven't gotten there yet. But you know, there's complications with LARC. There's complications, any potential complications, and failure rates with any type of contraception. I think most people who choose a tubal ligation like the convenience of it, and they don't have to worry about other forms of birth control. And I understand that. So, but any form of birth control will have a failure rate. And that should always be discussed in your options. Are you on the same page with that?
Yeah, exactly. And just a real quick comment, you know, the tubal that we perform usually laparoscopically before we use the Esure method, which is off the market at this point, is called an interval tubal. So that's when you're not doing it right after, at the time of delivery with a C-section, or like the next day, like Dr. Clark was mentioning, where we used to do those at Parkland too. We would line up 10 patients and it was so easy and convenient. The day after you deliver vaginally. Fortunately, I don't have that option in my private practice at this point, but you know, that interval tubal actually has a little bit of higher risk of failure compared to the tubal ligation that we perform at the C-section. So that's something to consider. But I always make sure my patients realize that there is a risk of regret. And there is a risk of failure. So it's very important to be sure that you're 100% sure that this is what you want to do and you're not considering pregnancy in the future.
And while we're on it, when you do a tubal ligation, it is considered permanent. It's permanent because we are removing a section of the tube. Is there a possibility for a tubal reanastomosis? Sure, but that success rate is very dependent on the operator who's actually doing it and even finding someone in your area to do it. So when you make the decision to do a tubal ligation, whether it's during a C-section, whether it's in the postpartum period, right after vaginal delivery, or in the interval period, you need to go in with the mindset that this is permanent. It's not tying the tubes in a bow or a knot and we just go in and untie them. You're actually removing a section of the tube. And I still feel like there's a lot of people who don't understand that or quite grasp that. So I want to make sure that people do understand that.
Yes.
Okay, next question. What is the likelihood of having a second fetal growth restriction pregnancy when the reason for growth restriction in the previous pregnancy cannot be determined? So I want to go over what the term fetal growth restriction means. So that's used to describe fetuses with an estimated fetal weight, which is an overall estimate of the fetal weight based on various measurements of different parts of the baby's body, or an abdominal circumference, which is an actual measurement of the circumference of the abdomen at a certain point in the abdomen. Either one, when that estimate of fetal weight or abdominal circumference is less than the 10th percentile for gestational age, meaning your baby is 28 weeks or supposed to be 28 weeks, but the abdominal circumference or the estimated fetal weight is less than 10th percentile when compared to all other babies at the same gestational age. The term small for gestational age is typically used to describe newborns whose birth weight is less than the 10th percentile for gestational age. So that's once the baby's born. Now, if we go back to fetal growth restriction, that definition, the less than 10th percentile abdominal circumference or estimated fetal weight, does not take into account the individualized growth potential of each fetus. And it may fail to identify some larger fetuses that have not achieved their growth potential yet. And it also doesn't take into account constitutional growth.
Right.
For example, if you have smaller parents, you have a 5 foot, 120 pound, pregnant person and their partner is 5'7", they're more likely to grow a smaller fetus. So
exactly.
We can't assume that. That's the little
trick. Yeah, no,
trick
it's hard.
I can't assume that it's because of what's called constitutional growth or growth delay. Because we can't look into that crystal ball and look at that baby and say, oh, that's just because mom or dad or partners are small or shorter. We have to still treat it like growth restriction and monitor as if it is. There are multiple reasons for a baby to be growth restricted or a fetus to be growth restricted. There's a whole box of them. If you go under my pregnancy highlights, I'll have information there. But overall, if you have a fetus that's growth restricted and you've had to be followed throughout your pregnancy, the risk of recurrence is about 20%. So if someone has a history of having a baby that was born small or growth restricted, reviewing the medical records to understand or try to figure out if there's any reason for that to have happened so that we know for the next pregnancy is ideal. And you may even decide to do more serial or more growth scans in the subsequent pregnancy. But as long as the growth in that subsequent pregnancy is okay, there's no indication to do antenatal surveillance via NSTs or BPPs. Mm-hmm. And there's no indication to do what we call umbilical artery Dopplers. That should only be done in fetuses that are confirmed growth restriction as defined previously, as I mentioned, on ultrasound. But it's just important to make sure you know exactly, you know, what happened in your previous pregnancy, especially with your new provider. Or if you have a new provider. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, that's exactly those are the definitions that I follow as well.
Right. Okay, now this is a good one. And I gave this one to you for a reason. This next question.
She's like, let Eric buckle up. This one.
Yeah. Okay. We're both on social media. And yeah. I'm going to tell you what, OBGYNs get kicked up and down the labor and delivery
lady.
Unit for having patients pushed on their backs. And these accounts or saying it's awful, it's bad for you, it's going to damage you, and that you should be able to push in any various forms of that you want it to push. So first question, is it really that bad to push on your back?
So I think it depends. I mean, I personally had all three of my kids and I did push on my back. I had them without epidurals. My first son, he had some fetal heart rate tracing abnormalities at the, and I think it's probably because it took me a little bit longer to push and I was pushing on my back and that happens because of the changes that with the blood flow and things to the uterus. I don't think it's bad if the patient feels comfortable with that position and it's working. I mean, honestly, I would say 99% of my patients do push on their back and they do well and we don't notice any traumatic issues with that or with that position. I mean, yes, you know, if a patient wants to do like a sideline push or a little higher up, one of my partners just delivered one of her patients on all fours and she had an epidural and she did great. So, I mean, I think it's just a matter of how you feel, what your comfort level is, and how your delivering doctor or provider feels about you. Also, you know, we have to take into account your blood pressure and how the baby looks and all that, but I think it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in the same boat, what I found is if you're interested in different ways of pushing, start the conversation with your provider early. Also, you can find out what the nursing staff on your labor and delivery unit do, because a lot of times nursing staff are pushing with patients. And if that's something that's really important to you, I know which one of my nurses are more experienced with pushing in different positions. Mm-hmm. We know as a labor and delivery unit that can be accommodated, but it's better to start those conversations early rather than to show up in labor and then start saying all this. I think two things need to happen. Patients need to be more willing to express their desires. and providers need to be more willing to listen and accommodate. It's a
two-way
street. And but I will say, as far as the epidural goes, sometimes the epidural patients are not able to get up into different positions, but definitely if they want to, and sometimes it's actually better if I'm have the patient push on their side, just because of the fetal heart rate tracing. And yes, if you're in a hospital, you're more than likely going to be monitored. That is an intervention, and that's happening. And a lot of patients prefer that for safety reasons. And I get that. But I don't want to make it seem like that's not an option for you. If it's something that's very important, make sure you let your provider know sooner than later so that you can have those conversations and have your, you know, at least have those conversations so that your wishes can be honored. I don't like what I see on social media all the time, making it such a bad thing, and that's all we are trained to do, because that is not true. I'm not saying that there are docs that's what they want and they're stubborn and that's not the only thing they're going to offer. I don't agree with that. But you can find out a little bit earlier where your doc might stand by having some of those important conversations earlier on in your prenatal care. So I think it's time that obstetrical care providers of all types, not just OBGYNs. Right. What is it, Judge? I love Judge Judy. I'm a huge fan. We have two ears and one mouth for a reason. Put on your listening ears, docs. Put on your listening ears, obstetrical care providers, and listen to our patients. Would you agree?
I love that. I agree. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were, because we're talking about pushing, about laboring down, and because we do get a lot of questions about that too.
I am a fan of laboring down, especially in someone that is complete and at zero station. I don't think anyone should push at zero station. Now, if they are a multip, a lot of times they will be complete and high. That's not atypical, but that comes with years of doing this. I know, you know, it's not necessarily typical for a prime mip to be complete and zero. And so if my resident tells me she's complete and zero station, I'm going to be like, but a multip is kind of more likely to do that. And they could push that baby out, and most times just like that. So am I more likely to push? And if they want to push at zero station and they're a multip, I'll try. But I'm okay with laboring down. I'm not okay with laboring down for hours. Yes. You know, this is totally anecdotal. I do think laboring down for too long can be associated with some more complications. There's nothing in the data. That's just my personal experience and my personal feelings. But yeah, I am definitely a fan of laboring down. What about you?
I love it too. Yeah. I mean, especially for our prime mips, we use the peanut ball. I feel like that works really well. And laboring down, I do think it cuts their amount of active pushing, or that active phase of the second stage down. So I love it.
Now, if the only caveat with that is that the patient really feels like they want to push and it's hard for them to push, I'm not going to say, no, you can't push. You got to wait. You know, the patient has a say in this as well, you know, and, you know, if there's, and sometimes that urge is just there and it's too strong and they can't hold off, and then we just got to go. So it's like, again, it's a two-way street. And you talk about other ways. What are some of the other ways that patients can push?
So like I was saying, you know, you can push on your side, you can push, you know, basically a little, you can do all fours, like I was mentioning before. And also like a little bit more of an upright position. Mm-hmm. But I think that you just have to do how, you know, kind of changing positions during pushing also may help anyway, just to make the mom feel more comfortable. And especially if there is a fetal heart rate tracing abnormality. So I'm all for it. And I'm happy that there's options, but like Dr. Clark said, bring it up early so that way we know what your wishes are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question. And this is another good one. Acetaminophen, Tylenol, or paracetamol is what it's also called as well, is category B. First of all, we don't use categories A, B, C, D, and anymore. X anymore. That's completely should not be used. Well, let me take it back. Medications are being phased out of that over time, but I forget what year it's supposed to be completely phased out. But really, in obstetrics, we don't use the A, B, C, D, and X anymore. A Johns Hopkins study analyzing umbilical cord blood samples found that newborns with the highest exposure to acetaminophen, Tylenol, paracetamol, were about 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD or autism spectrum disorder in childhood. Is it safe to take, or should it be avoided? So this is what I have to say. If you just think for a minute, how many things have you heard have been associated with ADHD autism spectrum disorder that people have done, been exposed to, taken in pregnancy. The list is endless. There's a reason for that, because it is very hard to find a definitive cause of anything with ADHD or any neurodevelopmental disorder or autism spectrum disorder to say this causes ADHD, neurodevelopmental disorders, autism spectrum disorder. So, and then when you're taking, especially when you're in these studies in someone that's pregnant, that's especially hard. So kind of like the MTHFR gene variant, it's been linked to 600 different conditions that biologically does not make sense. So anything you hear about taking in pregnancy being associated with autism spectrum disorder or neurodevelopmental disorders, you kind of have to take a grain with a grain of salt, because those studies are not the most ideally designed studies to make that kind of determination. What they'll say, there might be a link, but there's been no causation, there's been no association. So this study, the Johns Hopkins one, came out in 2019. In 2021, ACOG came out with a consensus statement, because there was also a something in Nature Reviews Endocrinology that, again, these they did a consensus about caution with Tylenol. It is one of the most studied and safest forms of pain control we could take in pregnancy. As with anything, it should be taken when indicated. It should not be taken at will and for prolonged periods of time, but that's the same for anything. And Tylenol, the main thing that you have to worry about is liver toxicity. And I've had a few patients inadvertently semi-overdose on it, not intentionally, because they were taking it so much they didn't realize. So that can happen in pregnancy. So that's really the main concern. But there's nothing definitive saying that. And again, SMFM also supports that. Do I prescribe and recommend Tylenol to my pregnant patients? I absolutely do. I tell them when they can take it. It's indicated if you're having pain or discomfort to the point that you are taking Tylenol for days at a time, you might need to be evaluated for something else to see what exactly is going on. Okay, so it is safe to take in pregnancy, but just like with anything else, make sure that you're taking it for the right indications. And if you're finding that you need to take it, or you're taking it a lot, then you need to be evaluated to see exactly what's going on. Anything to add to that?
No, that's exactly what I say too. Sounds perfect.
Yeah, I feel like pregnant patients are made to feel that anything they can do can cause a neurodevelopmental disorder, when that's one of the hardest things to study. And it's kind of not fair. I understand the interest in trying to figure out why these things happen, but there's so what we call multifactorial. There's so many things at play. We may not ever figure out what the top five reasons are that children might eventually develop neurodevelopmental disorders. So that's kind of where we are with that data. This is another good one for you. Are fetal kick counts the only way for pregnant persons to monitor their baby's health at home?
So, you know, I think it can be a good tool. Sometimes it may be a little bit harder for those patients that are very anxious people, because, you know, if they're counting and they don't feel 5 counts in an hour or 10 counts in 2 hours, they may think that something's wrong. We do know that if a pregnant person does subjectively report that there is decreased fetal movement, that there potentially could be a higher risk of an adverse outcome. But, you know, at the same time, I don't think we have enough data to say like this for sure is something that we need you to do or not do. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a mixed answer at this point.
Yeah, we can't say that if you do fetal kick counts starting at this gestational age and you do them this often, you're going to decrease your risk of stillbirth by X percent. We don't have that data. What I typically do, we educate on fetal kick counts, but just maternal awareness of, and you'll get to learn innately what your baby's movements are like. Some babies are more active at night, some are more active during the day, and you kind of get to know your baby that way. So if you notice something is off, that's when you need to be assessed and let somebody know. And then a lot of times we'll have the patient come in and then I'll talk to them about fetal kick counts. This is what you should do. And what I typically tell patients is this: if you notice that your baby is not moving or it grabs your attention, go somewhere quiet, lay down for an hour or 2 hours. You need to get five. If you don't get 5 movements in that hour or 10 in 2 hours, then you need to come in and be seen. Right. it can't be shrouded in fear, and because it can be very stressful.
It
and
can.
I just wish there was a magic recommendation we could give someone, but unfortunately there's just not. But do you use fetal kick counts? Like, what do you typically use for your recommendation of fetal kick counts?
I basically say exactly what you say. Go into a dark, quiet room, lay on your side, kind of start feeling any movement counts, as whether it's a light movement versus a sharp movement. But yeah, I mean, I don't routinely recommend it to everyone per se. I just tell them, like you mentioned, like awareness of your baby and kind of like what routine they have. And, you know, is there a drastic or a sharp change between one day to the next? I think that is the most important thing that you can follow. And then also as physicians and as providers, take it serious, of course, right? Because I've had a lot of times where I have a patient who I see for just a routine visit, and they come in and they're like, you know what, my baby's been moving less the last couple of days. And no matter what gestation, I mean, of course, if you, most of the time it's in the third trimester, I throw them on the monitor. I'm like, let's just make sure this baby looks okay and everything looks fine. So it's easy to do. It makes us both feel better. And I think it's something we have to take serious.
Yeah, and I also think, and I hear this a lot, that as the baby gets bigger, oh, you're 37 weeks, the baby is not going to move as much. Mm-hmm. That's not something we should be telling patients either. They should still be moving. So this, your baby has ran out of room argument that a lot of friends, family members might tell you, that is not accurate. If your baby is not moving like what it should be moving, you need to let somebody know. There's sometimes in the late third trimester, the baby's not moving because there's not enough fluid. There might be oligohydramnios, and you know, that's a reason for a delivery. So your baby should be moving at all gestational ages. And if it doesn't move and it concerns you, or it draws your attention, then you need to let somebody know so that you can be evaluated. Okay. Next question was antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. Now this could be a whole 5-hour.
That's a big but one just, right there, lady.
I'm just going to summarize it in a little bit. So antiphospholipid antibodies, they're associated with multiple medical problems that includes arterial and venous thrombosis or blood clots, some low autoimmune thrombocytopenia, which means low platelet count, and also fetal loss. So in addition to fetal loss and also recurrent pregnancy loss, it's also been associated with some obstetric complications like preeclampsia, growth restriction, placental insufficiency, and preterm delivery. So basically there's three antiphospholipid antibodies that we need to measure. I won't go over them, but they need to be measured. There's a laboratory criteria that has to be met to meet the criteria for a diagnosis of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. You draw those three antibodies at time period one and repeat in time 12 weeks later in order to get the diagnosis. Now, who gets testing for antiphospholipid antibodies? So basically, these are the people that would get tested for antiphospholipid antibodies. Number one, an episode of vascular thrombosis. So one or more clinical episodes are arterial, venous, or small vessel thrombosis in any tissue or organ. It is an indication to get tested for antiphospholipid antibodies. Or the category is called pregnancy morbidity. And that includes one or more unexplained deaths of a normal, morphologically or anatomically normal fetus at or beyond the 10th week of gestation that has been documented by ultrasound or direct exam of the fetus. Or one or more premature births of a morphologically or anatomically normal neonate before 34 weeks of gestation because of eclampsia or severe preeclampsia or features consistent with placental insufficiency. And then the last one would be, or three or more unexplained consecutive spontaneous pregnancy losses before the 10th week of pregnancy when other reasons have been ruled out, like an anatomic an abnormality of the uterus, or you know, you have thyroid disorder or anything like that.
Yeah.
Now, that has the three or more can be dropped down to two or more. So a lot of people or providers will initiate antiphospholipid antibody syndrome workup with two or more consecutive spontaneous pregnancy losses before the 10th week of gestation. Antiphospholipid antibody syndrome is not associated with late term or after 20 weeks stillbirths. It's associated with early pregnancy loss, which would be less than 10 weeks. So if you are diagnosed, you meet those criteria, you get tested, you have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. If you got the diagnosis based on a thrombotic event, meaning you've had a clot, then you're going to get a prophylactic anticoagulation with heparin throughout your pregnancy and 6 weeks postpartum. Plus or minus low dose aspirin. Some providers will do low dose aspirin. We don't where I work, but then some providers might do low dose aspirin. After delivery, you can either continue the injections of Lovenox or heparin. Some providers might switch you to Coumadin. That's a pill. So right. That is another option. Now, if you have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome diagnosed and you have not had a history of a thrombotic event or an arterial or venous thrombosis, then the recommendation is prophylactic heparin use during pregnancy and 6 weeks postpartum can be used. One meta-analysis found that for someone with recurrent pregnancy loss and a diagnosis of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, the use of prophylactic heparin and low-dose aspirin may reduce pregnancy loss by 50%. So some people might add on the baby aspirin as well. But if you have no, if you do have a history of fetal loss or recurrent pregnancy loss, but no prior thrombotic event, arterial or venous, then it's more than likely going to be recommended that you take the Lovenox or heparin injections, prophylactic mm-hmm. dosage, not therapeutic dosage, plus low dose aspirin during pregnancy and up to 6 weeks postpartum. So that's probably going to be considered. As far as antenatal testing, there's really no recommendation of when to start and when, how often to do it. So, but a lot of providers do just based on the fact that you have the syndrome. So that's more than likely going to be recommended for you.
Yeah.
Anything you want to add to that?
I had a patient myself that I took care of maybe about 2 years ago, and she had had 3 recurrent losses in wheat, and I tested her for it and she ended up coming back positive. So I ended up just doing Lovenox with her through the whole pregnancy, and she had a successful full term birth, and it was perfect. So yeah, I agree with all that. And I think it's important for us not to forget that syndrome, because we sometimes, you can kind of sometimes forget about it because it's not that common, but we have to check for it anyway.
Right. Okay. Next question. This is a good one. Is there a really big risk of getting adhesions or scar tissue with abdominal surgery, like a C-section or an exploratory laparotomy, to look for endometriosis?
Yeah, you know, this is a great question, since I do OB, but I also operate a lot. I do a lot of GYN surgery. It's always important to realize that with any open surgery, whether it be a C-section, a myomectomy, an ovarian cystectomy, or even a hysterectomy, if you do it open, which means through either a larger scar, fan and still, like a traditional C-section scar, or a vertical scar up and down, a larger one, that does put you at risk for adhesions. And adhesions are basically when tissue kind of sticks together. It can be your omentum, which is the fatty layer that covers your bowel, sticks to the anterior abdominal wall. It could be your bowel stuck to your ovary or your uterus, or your rectum stuck to the back of your uterus, things mm-hmm. like that. So there is a risk. I mean, I have found where, you know, I've done one C-section mm-hmm. and she has a ton of scar tissue. And I've done prior times four, and it's like a primary or a first time mm-hmm. C-section. So I think a lot of it has to do with probably just your tissue and how your mm-hmm. tissue reacts to inflammation and surgery. Of course, I think what plays a role is definitely the way your surgeon did your surgery, if they closed the layers or not. Also, if there was extra blood loss, if you can keep blood loss to a minimum, or make sure you have hemostasis is what we call it, that might help to decrease adhesions. And then there are some adhesion barriers that we can use at time of surgery that can also decrease adhesions or the scarring. And, you know, I actually had a patient who had a open cystectomy, ovarian cystectomy. She didn't get her whole ovary out. It was just a cyst. I didn't have the records, but it was probably 4 to 5 centimeters from what it sounded like she had. And she ended up having a partial small bowel obstruction during her pregnancy because of the scar tissue from the cystectomy. So, you know, it's one of those things where we have to be aware of it and know all your history. And so that way we can kind of put our fillers out to, you know, confirm if that could be a risk for you. But I think it's important that you know about that as a possibility.
Yeah, I make no assumptions based on someone's surgical history of whether or not they're going to have adhesions. I just assume everybody's going to, and I'm prepared for it. Because,
There you go.
Like you said, I've had patients that I've done the first, they've had one C-section, I go in for the second one, and it is cement.
Yes.
And I've had patients, I've had someone as many as 6 and 7 C-sections that not a lick of scar tissue. So a lot of it has to do with the individual. And, you know, you think about closing, I mean, you've had 6 or 7 C-sections, that's a lot of suture with all those C-sections, and they still don't have anything. So I just err, and I assume everybody's going to have its adhesions, and I prepare for it and hope for the best.
Yes.
But, you know, there's, like I said, I wish we had a table that said, if you had this many C-section, you get,
right,
after C-section 1, you have this percent chance of its scar tissue, and the scar tissue is going to be here. After 2, this percent... It's,
that would be helpful.
We don't have that. I would love that. Exactly. I would love that. But we don't have that kind of information. I think the person asked this because they were getting ready to have a C-section and they were very, someone had kind of scared them a little bit about them getting scar tissue. And, you know, can it happen? Absolutely. But, you know, there's no way to say what your chance of getting it and how bad it's going to be.
Speaking really quickly of scar, and I think someone asked earlier, not a couple minutes ago, about them having like a dimpling on their incision from their C-section, like will it go down or will it go away? You know, I think it probably won't, because it was probably the skin bunched up when they did the subcuticular stitch possibly, so it probably may not go down. It's hard to say for sure, but you know, I've had, what I always do is I'll cut this old scar out with a new section to just, so that way I feel like the new ends or the ends without scar heal together nicely and it's a little bit better. So, yeah, but I don't know if that dimpling will go away, lady. Sorry. The one who does.
Yeah, everybody heals a little bit differently, and the sub, you know, the layers of the sub-Q and how much subcutaneous tissue there has an effect on how well that incision comes together as well.
Yes.
And you know, there's so many factors at play. For me, if I see someone that has some pretty significant scarring from a previous C-section and they're not having any more children and they're getting a tubal ligation, I will take out that old scar. I will not do it in someone who is going to have future C-sections. Future babies, because you know, it's just going to happen again, and I just tell them, you know, we'll wait till, you know, you're done with childbearing, then we'll take out the C-section. But that's just different provider preference on how they do it.
Yeah,
different techniques. Yeah. Okay, next question: how common or dangerous is uterine atony?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I feel like lately I've been seeing it a lot. But uterine atony is basically when, remember, your uterus is a muscle. It's basically when your uterus doesn't clamp down or the muscles don't clamp down to decrease your risk of scarring. And it's usually the number one cause of postpartum hemorrhage, which we know is a, you know, very serious for pregnant people, and there can be major complications. So, you know, it is very dangerous. The beauty of you know, our technology and advances in medicine is we have a ton of different, what we call uterotonics or medication that helps us to clamp that uterus down to help decrease or minimize your bleeding. I think it's important for those listening, if you go home and you all of a sudden start bleeding heavily, there's a chance you might have a piece of retained placenta in there. Or there's also a chance you can have something, what we call subinvolution of the placental site, which can cause bleeding. But I always tell patients, if you're bleeding more than one pad an hour, or something that, you know, just, you know, this seems like a lot, I'm having large clots, like as big as, you know, golf ball size, that's not normal. We definitely want to see you back for that. And then now there's that new JADA system that came out for, you know, I haven't used it yet, but
yeah, we did the study here. So I was one of the PIs on the study.
Did.
So
okay,
yeah.
Great. So you guys, you've used it quite a bit, but, that's basically just a new device that helps to kind of it sucks, right? Like it suctions instead of the tamponade, which is the one we've always used, which is the balloon.
Bakery balloon.
The Bakery balloon, it suctions. So I think it might work a little bit better in terms of helping to decrease that atony. But yeah, there's a lot of different causes of postpartum hemorrhage. Atony can be dangerous, but I think in this day and age, we have a lot of options available to us. So I think it's good.
So the main thing about etnia, as Dr. Maltes said, is that the top part of the uterus is the muscular part, and it can contract, and it should contract fairly easily. But sometimes, with especially with labor and patients, the lower part of the uterus is not as muscular, and you could have the top part of the uterus contract down and get what we call lower uterine second etnia. The key is this: after a vaginal delivery, if the patient has bleeding, we have to figure out what's causing it. Is it etnia? Is it lower uterine segment etnia? Is it not etnia at all? You can't assume that all vaginal bleeding is from etnia. Or is it a laceration, a cervical laceration, a vaginal laceration? Exactly. So we have to figure out very quickly where the bleeding is coming from. You don't want to start treating uterine etnia when it's not uterine etnia. There's a cervical laceration, because it's not going to help. So as providers, we have to identify very quickly, because we've done enough deliveries. We know when too much bleeding is there. And we got to figure out very quickly where it's coming from so that we can address that problem. During a C-section, if someone has etnia, it's pretty easy to tell because the uterus is right there. You can see it. You can tell that it's what we call atonic, and then we can address it appropriately. And it's also easier to tell if there's bleeding from somewhere else, because a uterine artery was, cut, or there's a bleeding, bleeding from somewhere else. So identification is key. But yes, we have various medications in the hospital that can work. We also use TXA in those situations, tranexamic acid. I don't know if you guys are using that yet, but it's highly recommended in the setting of obstetric hemorrhage. So thankfully, in a hospital setting, we have a lot of tools at our disposal. We know when patients walk in who might be at increased risk for acne.
Exactly.
But then there's the cases where they have no risk factors and it comes out of nowhere, and you're like, why is this happening? And that's the part, from our standpoint, I'm sure you'd agree, that makes it scary, because you can't always predict.
Right.
I would say probably at least half the time when our patients have acne, I wasn't expecting it.
But I agree.
Thankfully, I was there. I had what I needed, and we got it taken care of. So acne is a serious thing, and needs to be addressed in a timely fashion.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say, I think we only have a couple minutes. Go ahead.
Well, how much more time do you have? A little bit more time, or do you need to go right to?
Yeah, I have a little more time. Yeah,
honey, so go ahead. What were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to say, one time I had a patient who was a primip. She wasn't in labor for too long, and she had, I had to transfuse her. I had to put in the Bakri balloon before the Jada system was available. And it was like, what the heck happened? I know she didn't have any retained placenta. And so for her second delivery, I was ready. I gave her the TXA, the Cytotec, everything. She still bled, but she didn't need a transfusion this time. And so, history always is important. And like Dr. Clark mentioned, which is an excellent point, have your records, so that way your new doctor, if you end up going to a different practice, will know what happened last time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next question. Fetal hiccups. This is a good one. I've never been asked this question, actually. When I Googled fetal hiccups, several websites tell me that after 30 to 35 weeks, an increase in fetal hiccups was abnormal and I should call my doc. Is this true? Is it indicative of an umbilical cord issue? So it just so happened that in 2021, a meta-analysis was done, which is a very high level of evidence study that showed that reduced fetal movements are associated with late stillbirth. And we've already talked about that.
Right.
With the association strongest when there are preterm gestations. Fetal hiccups and multiple episodes of vigorous movements are reassuring at all gestations after 28 weeks gestation. And that's just because that's when they studied was after 28 weeks. Not that it's not safe before 28 weeks. That's just when the study was done. And I even asked my very, very, very smart division director, who's been doing this a lot longer than me, I was like, is there anything up with fetal hiccups that's a bad thing? He was like, what are you talking about? So no, fetal hiccups are not a bad thing. The key is fetal movement, and when you notice a difference or a change in your baby's fetal movement, that's the key. But fetal hiccups are not anything to be worried about.
Yeah.
Okay. This is another question for you. How long should you wait postpartum to have a hysterectomy if you're 100% done having children and you want one electively?
So look, I don't think you should necessarily have a hysterectomy for sterilization per se. I mean, look, if you have issues with bleeding, you have known fibroids, adenomyosis, and you have all the endometriosis, and you're like, I'm done having kids and I have all these other GYN issues that make my life miserable, then yeah, I mean, that's something. And I think you could honestly really consider doing it if you wanted to do it as fast as possible, like maybe by 2 or 3 months at the earliest, I would say, because I would want the uterus to go back down to a normal size and make it easier for you to have a minimally invasive procedure, which is a robotic or laparoscopic hysterectomy, which the majority of the time we're able to do, but sometimes we have to make a little bit bigger incision in the lower abdomen to remove a specimen depending on the size. But I would not recommend to have a hysterectomy just for sterilization. You have a lot of other options for that, and definitely a lot more options that are lower, have a lower risk for sure.
Yeah, it's still a major surgery, and I agree with Dr. Montes. It's, you know, they should be done when it's indicated, not for sterilization purposes. But you know, getting a hysterectomy done, especially at a younger age, is not the easiest thing to do. I mean, you hear all the time that patients even need it and providers are refusing to do it. That's a whole nother discussion. And that's something that kind of needs to be changed, because it is becoming an issue for those who desire it, that are being told they can't for whatever reason, they're too young, or they might want to have children in the future. But in the meantime, they have horrid endometriosis or something else, and they are excellent candidates for having a hysterectomy. That's another topic. We won't get into that. The last topic I was going to talk about is estimated placental volume, but this is something I want to spend a little bit of time on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a post on this, because I do want to address it. I have done a lot of research into that, but do you have a few minutes just to go through, see if there's any questions?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Does anyone have, I'm sure there
were back there. I'm scrolling through. Scrolling back up. I know they're going to come up here soon. There's a lot of people on this call, on this live. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Oops. Doctor's nurse commented that he may have goofed the C-section closure because of the puckering dimpling around the scar still present 6 weeks postpartum. Will it flatten out? Okay, so I don't think that's appropriate. I think sometimes with our best efforts, it's hard to close the abdominal skin in a pregnant person. And one of the reasons is, like I said, the amount of fatty tissue that's there.
Right.
You go from a pregnant distended abdomen to a not so distended abdomen, and you're trying to get those skin edges together. You also have to take into consideration if this is, you're going through the same scar again. Those are always much harder to get together perfectly. So there's multiple reasons for puckering. And it also could be, she might be also referring to a dog tail. That's where the edge of this incision doesn't come together right. And you get like a little, looks like a little tail there. So, you know, if it's in the middle of your C-section and it's bothering you, you can do, what's it called, where the roll, C-section like, scar.
Like, I'm a,
like some PTs mean, can do that, where they roll.
Oh, the, yeah. How, like where, you know they, what I'm talking about? Where they kind of release the scar tissue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like help to raise the scar tissue. But that's done maybe a few months after to allow optimal healing so that it won't hurt you. So I don't know. I don't know what your body habitus is like. I don't know what your scar looks like. We can't comment on whether or not that will flatten out. But if it's still there and it's still bothering you, then that's something to talk to your doctor about.
Yeah.
Let's see. I know I am so meticulous about closing skin. And sometimes no matter what I do, it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to get it just tough. Perfect. Mm-hmm.
Do you all use suture or staples?
So most of the time we use suture, but there are some indications, and you know, I won't go through that, but where I do prefer staples, but that's on a case by case basis.
Yep, for sure.
I don't see, this is mostly people joining.
There were some, they were like earlier, but I don't know.
Earlier?
I read that one about the scar, but I don't know what the other ones were. I didn't read it.
Let's see. I don't think we have a lot. I think mostly we may have been answering everybody's questions. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll stop. If you guys have any extra questions that were not answered, this is going to be posted on my feed. And you could put the any extra questions in the comment section, so we might address those with the next session. Thank you so much for joining me. We're both post call.
Yes.
Hope we'll get to go home soon.
Okay, go get some rest. You have a great have a great weekend.
Yeah, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, sounds good. Bye.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. The next episode is also an Ask Us Anything session with OBGYN Dr. Fatima Dawood on more interesting topics.